Yeah.
I think that's where we're supposed to start.
Yeah, so today's reading is longer than yesterday's, and I've made little brackets for the readings. In fact, there's some pages that are skipped, so the first page and the back are part of a continuous part of the story. And then I skip to 255, and then you'll see a dot, 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 261, and then it continues. But in the actual book that this is from, this this particular allegory goes on for about 20 pages. So I took out the kind of the relevant parts of it. So I'll give you guys some background information about this, and really the topic is freedom. And so in my intro classes, I realized that students usually have a very deeply embedded belief that we have free will. And so I tried to make that more complicated and difficult for students. And so
that you might not have one.
That we don't
have
free will. And so Luther and Erasmus had a very famous debate about this. So Erasmus wrote a book on the freedom of the will in 1524, and Luther did a response, The Bondage of the Will, in 1525. And Erasmus used scripture to say that we do have free will, for example, the story of the fall, and other stories from the Bible. And he said these are clear examples of God giving us free will. And Luther said no, that if we take God's omniscience and power seriously, then we have to realize that we don't have free will, that it is somehow an illusion to think this. And in the debate, most people believe that Luther won just based on his rhetorical skill that he presented in that text. But it's really interesting because both Luther and Erasmus used scripture to be able to bolster their argument and clearly had passages that supported their views. So when we discuss it in philosophy, we have a particular kind of there are various theories on free will. So a libertarian believes that we have free will. A determinist believes that we don't have free will because of causal relationships, strict causal relationships between events, right? So if you think of, for example, a bowling ball, right, hitting pins, right, the pins have no say in the matter because a force caused them to be knocked over. And so some determinists believe that as physical beings in a physical world, we are subject to the physical causes that take place in nature because of physics and neurochemistry and all of those kinds of physical events that take place in us and outside of us. And therefore, we're like these pins in the bowling alley that are just kind of buffeted around by different forces. Then there's another view on free will, and it's called theological fatalism. And it's the view that we are powerless to change the future, that the future is already set, and that nothing we can do can change the outcome of the future that's already established. And so this particular argument is a statement of theological fatalism, and it starts out, so 1, 2, 3 are what we call premises of the argument. They're the pieces of evidence that we have that support the conclusion, and the conclusion is in statement 4. You can always tell a conclusion because it starts with therefore, usually. And so this is an argument against free will, and it starts out with the premise of God's omniscience. If God knows everything, then he knows what you're gonna do tomorrow. If he knows what you're gonna do tomorrow, there's nothing you can do to change that particular event or thing that you'll do tomorrow. And if you can't change it, then you're not free to make genuine choices or have alternatives between choices. So one of the ways that I describe this to students is we imagine the door is closed. And under the door comes an envelope. And the envelope, we open it up, and the first sheet says, "This is God, I'm in the hallway. And attached to this letter is a script of everything that's going to take place in the next 15 minutes, right? So don't look at the script. Just close this envelope back up and then carry on with class for the next 15 minutes. And so then we do that. And then when the 15 minutes is done, we open up the envelope and everything is in there, not just what we've said and what we've done, but even our private thoughts. Everything is contained within this. And that's what we mean by omniscience. And so some students try to get around that, and they say, no, he just knows what we're likely to do, because he knows us so well. He knows that we're going to choose a particular kind of ice cream over another or something like this. But we don't mean omniscience in that sense, right? That he's kind of narrowed it down to the option and has a pretty good idea of what we're going to do. If we mean he's omniscient, then we mean not just that he kind of knows, but that he really does know, right? That it's infallible. In other words, that there's no way that the script could be wrong. So if we tried to thwart the project, for example, say at minute 7, we said, let's take a sneak peek at what's going to happen in the last few minutes of class. If the script was accurate, if it was true that God was really omniscient, he would say at that particular moment that we looked, I know you're peeking right now, close the envelope, right? And so there's nothing that we could do to change the script. And so this is what we mean by omniscience. And so the idea of omniscience ends up complicating what we mean by free will. Now, a lot of students say, no, free will is present in the Bible in the story of the fall. It's so clearly there. We were given a choice to eat or not. We were disobedient. We're all inheritors of that original disobedience. And the reason why he gave us that free will was because he wanted us to be able to love him freely. That if there was a forced or programmed love, that wouldn't be genuine love. But Ari, when she was little, said, why did God plant the tree? Why was the tree there in the first place? So it's not just that he knows, but that everything is established and created by God. So his omnipotence also ends up being a complicating factor for this. He not only knows the script, but if we say that he's all-powerful, then we also say that he is the writer of the script. That there was no way for us not to have fallen. He knew us. He made us to be that kind of a being, right? So all of these kinds of factors play into this. It's an issue, and I think this is a wonderful riddle and puzzle. I wonder, you know, if this is something that we can solve or work at. Now, this is one of the important questions that we have in philosophy, and we say, well, what makes philosophy different from other kinds of disciplines? This is something that you can discuss with your granddaughter.
Okay.
That other kinds of questions we can take to a laboratory and we can test them. Philosophical questions are what we call non-empirical questions. We can't take them to a lab and test them. So when we ask questions like, does God exist? Do we have free will? What does it mean to be a human being? What is the good life? How should we treat others? These are not the kinds of questions that we can take into a laboratory and have some kind of consensus between scientists about what the answer is. And so some people say, well, then these are questions without answers. And last night I was trying to resist that and say, no, there are answers that we just have to find creative ways, perhaps, of investigating them through discussion or through rigorous thinking, or who knows, there could be other ways of discovering them. But to say that they're unanswerable, I think is problematic. So this is just kind of the philosophical backstory here. To the whole issue that's set up here in this particular text. So what I've given you is a passage from Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov. Dostoevsky was a Russian novelist who lived from 1821 to 1888 and is famous for two novels in particular, Crime and Punishment and The Brothers Karamazov. And they're both wonderful philosophically rich literary works. He also wrote short stories, Notes from Underground. He wrote another book called The Idiot. And he's often associated with existentialism because for him, freedom was really a central concern in all of his books. In Crime and Punishment, you have a character who commits a crime and then lives with the guilt for that crime. And so if we don't have free will, this raises all kinds of problems for what our responsibility is, because if we have no choice in the matter, then we're not responsible for our actions. If we do decide to harm someone, for example, right, and yet we had no choice in the harming of the person, right, we can't be held responsible, just like we wouldn't hold a lion morally responsible for attacking a gazelle, right, because we'd say they had no, the lion had no choice in the matter, it was just responding to instinct. He was, in a certain sense, programmed to do that particular action. Whereas with people, we think that there is some kind of difference. I can choose to do something or to restrain myself. And that's where we have moral responsibility is in the restraint or the actual doing of the particular action. So Dostoevsky believed that we have free will, and he believed that because we have free will, we also have moral responsibility and that we have to take it very seriously. So his novels investigate this particular philosophical problem. So he's interested in exploring morality, psychology, spirituality, and philosophy all in some kind of literary stew together. Some interesting biographical notes about him that I think are relevant to understanding what he thinks about freedom is that he was part of a secret society of intellectuals that held discussion groups about books, but they were also politically motivated and they had a vision, a utopian vision that they wanted to carry out, and so they were seen as being political radicals. And so he was sentenced to death, and he was before a firing squad. And at the very last minute, a note of reprieve came from the Tsar, and he was sentenced instead to hard labor in Siberia for 4 years. So he had a really close brush with death, right? I mean, couldn't get any closer. And then was released at the last minute. He was an epileptic, and a lot of interpreters have made a lot of that particular disease in terms of it being a source of creativity for him. He developed a gambling addiction late in life, and he influenced a lot of other authors like Chekhov and James Joyce and Ernest Hemingway and Jean-Paul Sartre, who was also an existentialist thinker. So the passage that I've given you comes from the Brothers Karamazov, and the Brothers Karamazov is a very interesting whodunit book. The father is killed, and so then the question is who killed him, and there are all these sons, and they all have very different personalities. So one of them is a novice monk, and another one, Ivan, is a budding philosopher. And Ivan tells this story of the Grand Inquisitor to his brother, the novice monk, who is very portrayed. The novice monk, Alyosha, is seen as being very naive, very simple, very gentle, and very kind. And Ivan is seen as being very cunning, very cynical, and very bright. And so these two brothers are very sharply contrasted against each other. And Ivan tells this story, you get the feeling, to kind of scare his brother, Alyosha, but also to try to wake him up from what he views as his kind of simple-minded faith. So in this story, Ivan imagines that Jesus comes back during the Spanish Inquisition. And so the beginning passage that I've given you here on pages 248 and 249, it starts out with Jesus coming back and walking among the people. Now, this isn't the second coming. This isn't kind of the end of time thing. This is just him coming for a brief moment because he has compassion for the people in the world. So he's just imagining what this would be like if Jesus were to reappear at this particular moment of history. And so Jesus walks through the crowd. The crowd immediately recognizes him. He raises a child, a dead child, and brings her back to life. And so it's reminiscent of a lot of the things that Jesus does in the Gospels. And all of a sudden, because this creates such a commotion, the Grand Inquisitor, who is a Roman Catholic figure who the day before had just burned 100 heretics in a grand display in front of the king, comes and has Jesus arrested. And then on the back of this first page, he questions Jesus. Jesus doesn't respond or talk to him at all at the beginning of this. And he says, why have you come to interfere with us? And he's like, you know that tomorrow I am going to burn you at the stake. And then Alyosha immediately interjects in the middle of the story and says, hold on, what's going on here? And Ivan is just like, just follow along with the story. You don't have to take this literally. This is a metaphorical kind of story. And so here again, we have an allegory like we were examining last night. So he's allowed to go on with his story. And in the next pages that you have, the Grand Inquisitor is talking to Jesus about freedom. And he's saying, you did all of these things for human beings to be free, but they can't handle it. It's not fair. They're not capable of doing it. So here we have a similar kind of story like we had last night, where we had somebody who went out and saw the truth and then came back and then was ridiculed and killed because of that. And so we have the same kind of situation where somebody has, we've been given this gift of freedom, but yet we're unable to deal with what that entails. And so here, the Grand Inquisitor says on page 251, for 1500 years we've been at pains over this freedom, but now it's finished and well finished. This is in the middle of the page. Because the Catholic Church has been trying to put the lid on the freedom that you've created, right? And so, and then on the next pages, he talks about Jesus' temptation by Satan, the three temptations that are described in Luke and Matthew, chapter 4, both of those books, and also briefly described in Mark, although very briefly. And the Grand Inquisitor goes through each of them, right? The turning the stones into the bread, the being thrown off the top of the temple, and then also presenting all of the kingdoms. Jesus has a response, and he denies all of those temptations in order to, the Grand Inquisitor says, to produce freedom in human beings. So 261, let's take a look at that page. So that's the, it should be the second page that you have on the front. And there's a little blurb that I've brought blocked off, and it starts out with a precious bit of information. In this paragraph, Ivan describes the Grand Inquisitor as somebody who isn't motivated by money, like he thinks that other church leaders are motivated by lucre, like the term for money, for material wealth. And he says, the Grand Inquisitor, who is now 90 years old, was originally motivated by a deep religious stirring. And so he suffered and loved mankind. And he also went into the wilderness and had a kind of a spiritual moment in the wilderness. And then when he went through this attempt to make himself, here it says, free and perfect, and loved mankind all of his life, he opened his eyes and saw that there is no great moral blessedness in achieving perfection of the will, only to become convinced at the same time that millions of the rest of God's creatures have been set up only for mockery, that they will never be strong enough to manage their freedom. And so at this moment, the Grand Inquisitor has a shift, right? That he realizes that the role of the church is not to promote the freedom that Jesus established, but to clamp down on it, to provide miracles, to provide people with food, to provide some kind of system of authority that keeps control on these people so that they can be led around like sheep, right? Instead of being able to be free in some kind of true and genuine sense. And then the very end of the story is on the back of the last page that you have, and I've bracketed it here. So he has, the Grand Inquisitor has given this long speech about freedom and how human beings can't handle it or can't deal with the inheritance that's been left by Jesus. And so the Grand Inquisitor says he was waiting for the prisoner, namely Jesus, to reply. And Jesus didn't say anything. The Inquisitor wanted him to say something, something maybe mean in response, but instead, here we have the old man would have liked him to say something, even something bitter, terrible. But suddenly he approaches the old man in silence and gently kisses him on his bloodless 90-year-old lips. That is the whole answer. The old man shudders. Something stirs at the corner of his mouth. He walks to the door, opens it, and says to him, "Go and do not come again, do not come at all, never, never." And he lets him go out into the dark squares of the city, and the prisoner goes away. So instead of burning him at the stake, he lets him go, right? And we're left with this riddle at the end. What did the kiss mean? Why did the Inquisitor let him go? Where did Jesus go after this? And so here we have this story that's presented as a puzzle. So last night we looked at an allegory. We said an allegory is an extended metaphor where there's some kind of hidden message or hidden meaning. In the next two sessions, we're going to be looking at parables, Parables are also a type of analogy that uses symbolic representation. In a parable, we have human figures as opposed to animals. If it were animals, it would be a fable, right? So you think of Aesop's fable. And a parable gives us some kind of moral instruction. Here, we're closer to an allegory again, like we had with Socrates, because we don't have some kind of instruction. We're left with some kind of puzzle or riddle. Who is the Grand Inquisitor? Why did Jesus come at that particular time? What did the kiss mean? How are we to understand our freedom in the context of all of this? What is the role of the church? Is this a critique of church? Is it a critique of science? Is it a critique of our particular age? Right. So we're left with all these questions, like we were left with questions last night. So just some ways of this has been interpreted as a parable or a critique of the Catholic Church. It's been discussed that Dostoevsky was trying to criticize Russian society of his time. And that here we have, in a very basic sense, a description of what Ivan thinks is the basic nature of man. And we also have a fundamental debate between freedom and security, which is something that comes up all the time in contemporary American politics, right? Should we be free or should we be secure? Should we be willing to give up our freedom so that we are safe? And so this is the issue that the Grand Inquisitor is really pressing us to think about. Can we handle freedom? Or when we have free, all of a sudden our security is gone, and yet we want to have the stones turned to bread. We need to eat, right? We're desperate for the food, or we're desperate for somebody with authority that will tell us what we should do, right? So here we are left with this puzzle. So I want to open it up at this point to discussion. If you guys are prepared to do that, I just threw a whole bunch of information to you. And this is a very interesting and very complicated story. And as I said earlier, I've only given you a small portion of the story. But I think that there are several interesting things that we can talk about just by using these pieces that we've already examined.
So when it comes to speaking of we and freedom, are we basing this on the acceptance of the majority?
Yes.
The bright and the simple? Where do they fit in?
Right.
That's a problem.
Yes, it is. And Ivan, right, even in describing the story to Alyosha, is trying to criticize his simple faith and trying to say, wake up and see the complexity and the difficulties that are present here in these kinds of, when you take all of these intellectual elements and try to put them together, right? That it can't be something that's just simply believed once you know all the complexity. But yet, Alyosha is seen as being the better of the two characters because of his gentleness and his simpleness, right? That Ivan is kind of pressing this stuff against his will, right? Yeah.
Yeah, it's a problem when you want to have a, you tend to think that, well, okay, we need to have a society that has both sectors.
Yeah.
And
right.
Still have happiness between the two, like two different races.
Mm. Yes.
Good thing life isn't so long. You don't have to deal with it.
Yes.
Very long.
Yes. Right. And so I wonder if there's a way, and this is the way I tend to think about it, is that we often think one of the things that came up last night in the cave allegory, if there are people who have different or competing views of what our purpose is or what the truth is, how can we all get along, right? This is a fundamental question. We can say, well, we know that they will be in constant debate with each other and struggle, but then we can say, but isn't that where we discover what the truth is through that discussion or dialogue? And this is a good point because when we're thinking about philosophical questions, the ones that can't be tested in a lab, we say, well, then how are we going to discover answers to these kinds of questions? How are we going to get along? How are we going to understand free will? And so philosophers use different kinds of methods, and that's what I wanted to experiment with in this series or different ways of looking at philosophy, because typically when people read philosophy, they read essays, treatises, right? These very systematic approaches to things like free will. If you read Luther or Erasmus's book, for example, they're very logical books and essays that progress through premises to conclusions. And this is kind of a very typical philosophical format. But prior to the essay and treatise, we have dialogues. We have Plato's dialogues, where there are people in conversation with each other who have very different ideas about how we define basic terms, right? How we understand freedom, how we understand virtue or piety. And they're discussing with each other and oftentimes don't come to a conclusion. And Socrates is fine with that, because he says what we need to do is we need to clear away the falsehoods. And even that is some kind of progress, if we can clear away falsehoods, right? Now, some people are unwilling to clear away falsehoods because the falsehoods that they cling to are so strong, right? Do you need some readings?
I'm sorry I'm late.
That's all right.
That's a false premise.
Okay, which one?
If God knows everything, he knows what you do tomorrow, mm-hmm. Okay? If he already knows what you will do tomorrow, then you cannot do otherwise. But that's all it says when God knows what you will do tomorrow is if you're going to change your mind or change things, God is already aware of that. He isn't programming you. You're still free to do whatever you want. God just knows it. That's all. That's all it's saying. God's not programming you. God's not doing anything to you. God just knows.
Okay, so I'll try to complicate that a couple of ways. So the first one is with just simple omniscience. Say the example we use is imagine that God has a script that's all written there. And we don't have to say who wrote the script yet, right? Because that's a different issue. But say he knows everything. If he knows that you're going to eat a Tootsie Roll next week on Thursday at 5 p.m., right? And you're looking at that Tootsie Roll at 4 o'clock and you're thinking, I have a real strong feeling that I can either choose to eat this tonight in an hour, or I can put it in my pocket and I can eat it in a couple of weeks, because Tootsie Rolls are wonderful for having a really long shelf life. Or I can save it for my granddaughter or something like this, right? I have a real distinct awareness that I am making some kind of choice here. Now, if we mean that God is omniscient, we're not saying that he knows that you probably will eat it because you like them, or that he knows that you probably will save it for your granddaughter because you want to do something nice for her. We know, if we're saying omniscience, he actually knows that you're going to eat it at 5 o'clock. Right? So even though you have some kind of distinct awareness of making a choice or feeling like you make a choice, it isn't a choice, because there's a truth about the future that already exists in his mind.
But you're mixing God's will and God's knowing.
It's sufficient that he knows for it to already be a truth in the future.
But all he knows is what you end up doing.
Right, but if he knows what you end up doing, there's no way for you not to eat it. Say he knows you're going to eat it at 5.
Well, you're saying, right? You have to eat it at 5.
Yes.
But God isn't saying you have to eat at 5.
It doesn't matter who's saying you have to do it. If he knows that you're going to eat it at 5, you're going to eat it at 5.
All he knows is what you're going to do.
Right. But there's nothing. There's no way for you to...
Go ahead.
No. This is wonderful, because the second part that I can use to complicate it is, if God made you and made everything, right, then we're talking about omnipotence, and that makes it doubly hard. But I think it's sufficient to say, at least along this argument, that free will is complicated just by him knowing. Because that means that there is a truth about the future that's true right now already. And you can't change it to be false. Because if you change it to be false...
But what is true is only what you end up doing.
Yes. But so when you think that you have a choice to eat it or not...
You do.
But what does that mean?
That just means you went a different course than what you were going to do earlier. Or someone thought you might do. That's all.
Okay, so the example I used earlier was, if there was a script that came through the door, right? And on the top of it, God said, this is me. I have a script of everything that's going to take place in the next 5 minutes. Right? And and so close this up. And so we have the next 5 minutes. We look back into the script, and he described everything that we said and that we thought and did, from like scratching our face to thinking about this argument or whatever, right? And it's all present.
But the script is not written beforehand. The script is only what actually happens.
Okay, so then we have to change what omniscience means, because then we can say that he only knows about the present and the past, but not that he knows what's going to take place in the future.
If we understand that God thinks in terms of timeline.
Okay, so that's Boethius's attempt to try to solve this puzzle. He says that God's time is different from ours, that it's not linear, that it's everything all at once.
Yeah.
But I think there's still a problem there, because if we're saying that the future is included there, then there are truths about our future that are already included in his present, that we're powerless to change.
Yeah, see, the difficulty I have is that I've always understood omniscience in the sense that God just knows it.
Yes.
Not that he programmed it. Not that we are absolutely free. God knows that, and knows if he's omniscient, he just knows what we end up doing.
Can I,
without a
yes.
script beforehand?
Yeah.
I'm curious what you mean by you. Or is it your conscious level? Like you think you have freedom to choose? Because there's actually, coming from a neuroscience background, there's actually evidence that I could go measure, do fMRI measurements on your brain, and see that there is subconscious activity that you're not even aware of, and I can measure that upwards of 6 to 10 seconds before you ever make a decision about something. So there are even mechanisms in your own brain where you don't have conscious awareness of it, of choice that you've already made.
And is that
conscious awareness of it?
Yeah,
that's just localized to yourself.
And does that come from God, or does that come from
all kinds of other things? I'm saying that's just pure
neuroscience,
how the brain works.
Okay.
Yeah, but that's more consistent with causal determinism than the fatalist argument. Because the fatalist wants to assert that there are truths about the future that we're powerless to change, whereas the causal determinist says that there is only one outcome based on the stew of causes that produce that one outcome, right?
And that's based on, like, in the definition of omniscience, like a pre-existent foreshadowed knowledge.
Yes.
So
Aristotle had a version of this that didn't involve God, that he believed was called logical fatalism.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, either there will be a sea battle tomorrow, or there will not be a sea battle tomorrow. We know that that statement is true because it's a tautology. There's no way for it to be false, right? He says, well, if it's true now, then one of the sides of that disjunct, either a sea battle will happen or it will not, has to be true now as well in order for the tautology to be true now. So there has to be a future truth, and there's nothing we can do to change it. There exists these future truths, and no matter what takes place in the meantime, if that really is a truth and we're serious about it being a truth already, right, then whatever we do right now is moot, because that was the truth about what would take place at that particular time tomorrow.
Was this Luther's final argument in his life?
Luther's strongest argument against free will was about God's omniscience, that he says that if we're really taking his omniscience seriously, then we're not free, right? But then he also uses scriptural evidence to bolster his argument. But Erasmus says, no, he's like, there's evidence in the Psalms, there's evidence in Genesis, and there are all kinds of passages that talk about us making choices and about God giving us choices. So it's fascinating. So we were talking earlier about the debate between Luther and Erasmus, that Luther in The Bondage of the Will talks about how we don't have free will, but Erasmus wanted to wanted to establish some kind of serious debate between the two. And they really fell out between each other. And what's interesting is that Erasmus, in some senses, was sent by the Catholic Church to argue against Luther. And Erasmus wanted to criticize the Catholic Church as well for their abuses, but didn't want to break off from it. So there were also kinds of political underpinnings to their argument as well. One of the fascinating things that I discovered is that the Inquisition, right, the time that this story is supposedly took place, was really in its kind of greatest climax in 1480 to 1530. But when Todd just looked up the Inquisition now, the technical dates were 1481, and it was finally finished in 1834. So that was when they finally must have sent out a decree or something that it was over, which is interesting because then that time period overlaps with Dostoevsky's life as well. And so the debates about freedom that were part of that time period, right, were something that I think for Dostoevsky were quite alive and that he saw some kind of rich theological importance to them. Yeah. I appreciate your concerns about this because I think it's really troubling.
But yeah, that would be a real problem for me because I keep on hearing people, God, it's God's will that you know, come on.
Right, and that's one of the things that we talked about a little bit earlier. If we don't have free will, then we can't be held responsible for anything.
Yeah.
Right.
Is it getting to I think I agree that what's number one doesn't fit number four. That you're almost talking about definitions of what's omniscience mean and what does free will mean. And I'm not seeing where they necessarily, that follows, that comes from that.
Good.
If that's Luther's employment of omniscience, it seems to actually contradict his later theological beliefs on both salvation and salvation of the cross.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's different understandings of omniscience. There's different understandings of free will. So two different definitions of free will that I can offer you are, one is metaphysical free will. This is the belief that we have a genuine choice, right, to eat the Tootsie Roll or not, that it really is a matter of freedom, right? And then there's another version.
It's a matter of human nature.
Yes, and some people say that it's so clear that we have that because we all have a distinct awareness of it all the time. Like when we're looking at a menu, for example, that somebody might say, well, we're under some kind of illusion to feel that, but we all feel that. And there seems to be a very strong and compelling argument from experience that that's how things are. But some other philosophers say, no, we don't have that. It's just simply a feeling, and feelings aren't proof or evidence. We could all be duped, have some kind of grand illusion that we really just don't know what's going on in our brains, for example. And so the language that we apply to it, because we can't understand it, is that we're free, right? So some neuroscientists are kind of going down that route, right? The examples that they give are somebody goes through an MRI scanner and says, okay, choose left or right, just do it randomly. And they say these regions of the brain light up 6 seconds before you actually make the conscious choice. So the person that's watching the computer can predict accurately which one you are going to randomly choose based on how your brain is activated. So some philosophers say we don't have metaphysical free will. We don't have these genuine choices. We just have what we call circumstantial free will. So if somebody isn't forcing you or putting a gun to your head, then we call that free because then we can allow us to be morally responsible in those cases, even if they are strictly causally determined. And so we don't have genuine alternatives, right? But we're just free when we're not being forced.
That seems to me that would play to the acceptance of the simple-minded. I don't know if I said that right, but
Yeah.
Rather than those that are more intelligent and analytical and think for themselves as far as issues of safety and livelihood and on.
Yes. Yeah.
There are times, and maybe lots of times, when we are not free in the sense that we have been programmed by life experiences, whatever else. Maybe some genetic kinds of things, but that can be changed through counseling, through surgery, through different kinds of So in that sense, there always is freedom to move away. And in the relationship with God, the turning away from evil, and we are drawn to God. We can say that's an irresistible force also. But that is again a change that is possible to break that pattern that we seemed entrapped in. So, you know, that's repentance, forgiveness, you know, that whole refocusing of life that goes on. And we can talk about how the power of God draws us into that. But we can also say no to that.
Yeah. So it's interesting because we can make a clear distinction between things that we aren't free to do. Like, I would like to fly, but I can't. Mm-hmm. I can't choose who my parents are, right? There are certain things that, right? But when we're talking about other kinds of things, right, how I'm to treat people, then those are the kinds of things where we say that we think that we're free. But I want to just close again with Ari's statement when she was a little girl, because she was reading a children's Bible that was talking about Adam and Eve. And she came to me with the most profound theological question I've ever heard in my life. She said, why did God plant that tree, right? Why was the tree even there? If he didn't want us to eat it, right? Why was the tree there? And so, of course, I can't respond to that kind of a question. So what do you think? Right? What do you think, Ari? And she said, so that we'd learn the hard way.
And we still are.
We still are. And then I told this story to a pastor friend, and he said, and that's why Jesus had to do it the hard way, too. So... yeah, I think this is a very interesting, complicated puzzle about what is our relationship to freedom and autonomy. I think it's very fascinating in this story. So I didn't treat this fairly enough in this small amount of time. So feel free to take this with you and read it. And if you're interested, I can also send you the longer version, because this is the redacted one. But it's 5, and I will be on time today. So thank you for coming.
Thank you.
You can ask the